Okay, welcome back to Firewall. As usual, I'm your host, Bradley Tusk. With me today is a guest I'm really excited about because I've been a fan of his for a very long time. I want to introduce him first and then tell the story of kind of how I got into his work. But Daryl Pinkney, thank you so much for joining us. We're really honored to have you.
Thank you for having me. I'm the one who's honored. It's really kind of you.
So I'm going to give your bio because I suspect that if I asked you to do it, you would be far too modest. So it's probably easier for me to list all of your accomplishments. Author of two novels, High Cotton, which we'll talk about, and Black Deutschland, three different works of nonfiction, including one that came out last November called Busted in New York. That's a great series of around 25 different essays. Write for the New York Review of Books, Guardian, Harper's, LA Times, The Nation, New Republic, The New Yorker, and so on, Paris Review, have done theatrical collaborations with director Robert Wilson, Hodder Fellow at Princeton, the Harold Varsell Award for Distinguished Prose from the American Academy of Arts, a fellowship from the Guggenheim Foundation. So is there any prize they haven't given you yet?
You make me guffaw like Uncle Reed.
So here's my Daryl Pinkney story. Maybe we'll make you feel old, but so I read High Cotton when it came out, and I was in college at the time, and you came to campus to speak, and I went to see you speak, and I was probably like a freshman or sophomore. I was still pretty early, and I remember just like being so impressed. Like, here was this guy that to me, it was even more than whatever you said. It was just like sort of like cool adult who was literary and thoughtful and self-assured. And it really just, it stuck with me. And then I actually entered the creative writing program, I think in large part, because, you know, I saw what you were like. And to me, that was kind of a great inspiration. So a belated 28 or so years later, thank you.
I'm stunned. I'm very touched by that. Were you a student?
I was at Penn. I don't know if you remember speaking there. It probably would have been like 92, 93.
Yeah. It's probably 93 because I was still in England. I mean, I didn't come over for, I can't remember, but I'm flustered. I'm so.
No, I was so excited when the idea of you coming on the podcast came up because I've been a fan for so long. So
You know that matters a lot. It's always very hard to do anything, and so it's very generous of you to say these things.
And I imagine this I'm sure happens a lot, which is
no, that's the point. It doesn't.
Where it happens a lot isn't that
you put it away and you appreciate it.
But you have a broader impact on people's lives than you're necessarily always able to be aware of, just because you're aware of what crosses your plate. And until today, I've never crossed your plate. Hopefully the story is not just, something to kind of put away and be happy about, but probably recognize that the same thing is true times 100 of other people who just haven't.
You will be in the next thing I write.
Yeah, there we go.
I mean, what you say will help me write the next thing.
Mission accomplished then. We could stop the podcast right now. So, you've been writing about...
And you're not exactly unknown yourself.
Well, I'm not Daryl Pinkney, but I appreciate it. So...
I meant about influencing lives.
Yeah. Well, that's the upside of politics, is you get to have a pretty broad reach.
Yes.
For better and for worse, but hopefully mine has generally been for better.
I'll say.
So you've been writing about race and class and society and government for a really long time, for your whole career. And here we are in this moment, which at least to me as a white guy feels unique in that there seems to be some greater recognition and appreciation of what the world must be like from people like me. But again, I'm looking at this from a, still somewhat distance perspective. What does it feel? What are we in right now? How does this all feel to you?
It does feel very different from previous, protest or certainly it's different from what I remember about the 60s, though I was very young then. 50 years have gone by or more. And I'd say that... the biggest change is that of white people. You know, this kind of across the board, across class, across divisions, you know, a sense of the world, and that actually more than one minority. You know, America hasn't just blacks as a minority. It feels very different, very transformative for institutions. And I've never seen so much coverage of race in the New York Times or the Washington Post before. Some of the quarrels that defined the movement in the 60s vanished now. I have relatives who speak of equity, not equality. And that's very different. Also, reparations used to be a kind of black nationalist fringe conversation, and it's utterly mainstream now. So in a way, this is the revenge of affirmative action. We're so far beyond integration and tokenism, you know, of the past. I think that the lockdown and the pandemic, their influence on, or their the part they played in what has happened can't be underestimated, not just because people were confined and so whatever one was watching became a sort of national narrative that we hadn't had in a long time, but also everything Black Lives Matter had been talking about was suddenly very dramatized. Everything Occupy Wall Street had been talking about was suddenly very dramatized. It was lost on no one. The class character of the pandemic, who had to go to work, who had to show up, who had to make the deliveries just so that we could get food and videos or books ourselves, who was dying in relation to the percentage of the population that group represented, the vulnerability, not just of the poor and the dispossessed, but of working people. And it sort of freed us of Trump's sort of control of the news, the reality. Suddenly this kind of thing seemed so irrelevant and small and ill-equipped to cope with what's really going on in the world. And he gets smaller and smaller every day. I mean, we've underestimated the white backlash before, but certainly the pandemic itself, I think, revealed the true nature of his spirit. You can go to work and you can die. You can come to my rallies and you can die. Meanwhile, I will be tested every day. And I think this is clear even to his party, that somehow none of this matters anymore or isn't going to help us. So I think a lot has changed, yes.
Yeah, and I think you're right about that. We had Congressman Eric Swalwell on a few days ago, and we're talking about sort of, is there that moment where Republicans in Congress start to just jump ship and say, look, you know, this is so clear now to the voters.
If he wants to destroy the Affordable Health Care Act, this is their chance.
Right, right. So hopefully, you know, we are seeing some, like I think you saw George W. Bush say wouldn't vote for him. So maybe this is the beginning of a kind of acceptance on the other side to distance themselves. But I might be being way too optimistic. So how do you handle a moment like this? Are you writing about it? You working on a book about it? What do you do?
You know, I mean, well, I'm certainly trying to write something at the moment. I mean, I couldn't right away. So much was happening. And also, I am confined. I couldn't go to the demonstrations. I tried to go to one, but I'm over 65. And how did that happen? But I didn't want to wade into, you know, the group of very emotional, mostly young people, even if they were all wearing masks, which most of them were. I just, you know, it was weird to miss seeing what was going on and only getting it by visitors stopping at my front door or relatives on Instagram or, you know, following it in the papers. Harlem is very quiet. And so the lockdown was very far away. It was sort of sirens in the distance. So that was strange. And, you know, I didn't want to, I mean, all these writers under lockdown, early on, I put away Thucydides and Pepys and Boccaccio and Defoe because it wasn't this wasn't helping me.
Right.
When I got my hair cut, I sort of started behaving better or more normally for me. When I looked really crazy, I acted really crazy. Because I, my hair doesn't sort of grow like Cornel West's hair does.
He has cool hair.
He has cool hair. I have stupid hair. So looking in the mirror, I was just this person who had fallen apart. I'm very fortunate in my partner and that we work at home anyway. And so, it was just kind of the fortress of the self. And that's not good for writing. You think it is, but actually it's not because you sort of dry up. So I just started reading anything and everything. Lydia Davis or Ben Nugent or Zadie Smith or James McPherson, William Taylor, Eric Foner, the Goncourts, lots of sort of art books that you get but don't really kind of look at after the exhibition. And all of that sort of helped. What helped the most was reading Whitman and just sort of, it opened, opened me up to thinking about America. Elizabeth Hardwick always told our class to read poetry before you write prose because it gives you the sense of possibilities of language. And also she recommended reading something that had nothing to do with what you were about to write about for the same reason.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes total sense. So you wrote Black Ball. It's funny. You wrote it, 6 years ago, 2014?
Yeah.
And yet in some ways, it feels like you could have almost written it this year in a way, right? Which is kind of in the sense of, I think the issue of kind of Black voting rights is hopefully a lot more apparent to people in the moment that we're in. So how do you think that there's a unique opportunity at this moment to kind of strike a blow against some of the different voter suppression tactics?
Yes. I hope so. It's hard to say, given the nature of the courts after 4 years of Trump appointees. But certainly everyone is aware of it. People are very alert to different styles of voter suppression and what always sounded like the plot of political thrillers. We now accept as this kind of a reality, in our peripheral vision that has more, that maybe matters more than we think. So I think people are alert to it, but it does mean that the other side is alert to it also. And so late polls open, early voting, voting absentee, voting by mail, all these things will be threatened state by state, depending on sort of who's in charge and who's watching. Yes, I think very much in the air. I was very struck that LeBron James.
Oh, yeah, he had that whole voting initiative now, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is exactly, this in this day and age is the person you want talking about voting. It's always been a frustration to people my age that the wing of hip hop that or rap that gets the most attention was not always the most thoughtful wing.
He's different.
He's
Michael
different.
Michael Jordan in some ways was notable for the fact that he just said, hey, I'm about making money and winning championships. And, okay. Whereas LeBron seems to really have a deep social conscience, which is
many years in between.
And,
so, yes. And this also is, I think, generational. You have this generation that has been learning and also faces a future very different from any generation before.
Right.
That is one of total uncertainty.
Yeah.
So anger lurking in them is nothing like even the Vietnam generation that, was rejecting a way of life, not looking for one.
My kids genuinely believe that the world could come to an end in the next 20 years because of climate change. And on one hand, it's sort of an awful way for them to live. On the other hand, they're, my daughter's 14 and she's really active and she's doing things, and that's probably the only way it's going to change. So you know, on one hand, I hate for her to have to feel that way. On the other hand, like, it's certainly motivating her.
Yes. Well, good for her. And it would be hard for her in your household not to care about things.
Sam. The dog decided to weigh in on the podcast. So then, you know, in thinking of your comment about kind of the generations between Michael Jordan and LeBron James, kind of your comments earlier about kind of awareness in this particular moment around race and coverage, and even about my daughter, and this is something I've been wondering about lately. I mean, do you think people evolve in a more moral direction over generations and time, or do you think people are just people and some are good and some are not, and it's kind of always the same?
That would be so hard to, you know, answer in the time we have. You know, the discussions and everything changes over time. Events govern what's on our minds, or someone steps forward and, you know, says this should be on our minds. It's hard to describe how change works because social change isn't uniform by any means. And, you know, as many good things that are happening now, there are some sort of excesses that I hope we kind of roll back from eventually. In the same way, you can look back on the 60s and some of what was said was, you know, out there for the time and a document of that time. I think we sort of have that as well. Jill Nelson said to Henry Louis Gates some time ago that she was sick of going to demonstrations that were all black or mostly black, and it was time for the white people to show up. And they did. All those kids did, even though some of them were just kind of, I don't know, doing it because it's the thing to do or the acceptable social thing to do in a medical emergency. Don't go to the bar, but you can go to the demonstration.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, they showed up. And from what I saw in many of them, you know, this was real. So it's, I think also this, and I think the credit should go to Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter in Ferguson, that made the point that have an impact, you have to stay there. You can't demonstrate and then go home, that you really have to build somehow. And so, you know, I think this is kind of a shared movement, even though there's a lot of sort of deference to the Black point of view. It is very much a kind of shared movement because, you know, when people say Black Lives Matter, the first thing I hear is all lives matter. You don't have to say all lives matter when you have Black Lives Matter. You just have to identify with Black Lives Matter. Yeah. I think where the universalism of civil rights that King spoke about is very clear now. You know, this matters to everyone. It's not civil rights, it's human rights. Or not just civil rights, it's also human rights. So I think that your daughter's generation, you know, they're all kind of recognize that they're in this together. And so it's a victory for people like Ella Baker and Bayard Rustin, who spoken in terms of coalitions more than anything else.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. We're kind of actually this morning started conducting a little bit of an experiment. We normally live in Manhattan, but we're at our place in upstate New York since COVID hit. And we put up some Black Lives Matter signs this morning. And I'm curious to see kind of how the neighbors react to it. Everyone's very nice, but we're in kind of a county that went for Trump in 2016. And in some ways, whatever the reaction is, good or bad, it'll probably be a decent indication to see how far some of that perspective has traveled outside of the kind of big cities that a lot of us tend to live in, and that kind of a bubble that we all tend to live in a little bit.
Yeah, but I saw that photograph of the woman in sort of small town California mopping tar over Black Lives Matter in the street.
Yeah, so, we'll see if our signs come down.
Yes, you know, what is the cost of personal whiteness? Yeah. You know, whatever it is, it's too high. It's too high. Yeah. And upstate New York is interesting because there's a lot of, I gather, local resentment of people from the city anyway.
It's a weird dynamic because, you know, we've been up here full time now for about four months. I've seen it in a way that's been different from before.
Right.
There's some resentment, and yet at the same time, it also drives a lot of the local economy, right?
Yeah.
Because it's a lot of people coming for the weekends or you know, employing lots of other people to do things to make it possible for them to be there. And so it kind of cuts in both directions. And even on the district that we're in upstate, the county voted for Trump, but at the same time, Antonio Delgado, who's an African-American, ran for Congress in this district and won, right? So it's, you know, you kind of see all these contradictions all happening at the same time, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, every time you make a general point, the exception or the opposite thing is sitting right there next to it. So it's very hard to say. I think also that 2016 was so traumatic to people like us and getting it so kind of wrong that we're anxious about it again. But I think also it's in some way, you know, we always look to the federal government and the court, Supreme Court especially, as deliverance. And I'm still very suspicious of Gorsuch and Roberts and don't trust their point of view, as I understand the Federalist Society philosophy. But when I listen to discussions of what to do now and how to make this last or extend to something else, I hear people saying very openly, it won't be the government. You know, they almost want to vote just to stop Trump, but they, you know, the solutions, it won't be the government. You know, and they're calling on much more on business, or Robert Smith's proposal that corporations set aside 2% a year. I think that the private initiatives will, for now, certainly far outpace what the government will respond to, just because it's been so, you know, injured by the Trump administration.
Yeah.
So crippled. You know, 70,000 people were let go from the State Department in the first 3 months of his tenure.
70,000?
That's what I was told.
Wow.
A friend said that in the diplomatic corps from elsewhere, I can't say, said you rang Washington and the phones just, you know, just kept ringing because there was nobody there to pick up.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of that kind of context and contradiction we were talking about probably applies here too. So, I mean, I don't know Roberts or Gorsuch, but I went to law school at the University of Chicago, so it's kind of a hotbed of the Federalist Society.
Yes.
A bunch of my classmates have become appellate, you know, been appointed by Trump to the appellate court over the last couple of years. And so I know some of these people now. Mm-hmm. And on one hand, their judicial philosophy probably wouldn't reflect how you or I would rule on cases if we were on the bench. On the other hand, you know, they're complex, intelligent people, right? And I don't think they're going to be kind of reactionary, you know, they're not Trump, right? And I think as norms change in society, you know, people change with them. And so you see a Roberts or a Gorsuch weighing in on the side of LGBTQ rights or even kind of preserving the Affordable Care Act, which Roberts did. And so, you know, if I had to predict how at least a few of my classmates serve on the appellate court, they're conservative unless they've changed since I went to school with them, but they're probably not if they got nominated by Trump.
Right.
But I also think that some of the different evolution and thinking on issues, like I think climate is probably another one, will also be reflected.
I think that's the big one coming. You know, since he rolled back every environmental protection that we had, which were not much in the first place, all of this in some ways has to be revised somehow. And it's a global problem, not just Pennsylvania's problem.
Yeah.
But as you see, I mean, in a few minutes, how large the discussion gets. And it's what happens these days. You start talking about something in particular and you go on and on, which is not a bad thing. Because for a long time, since 2016, I was thinking if you were a person who couldn't imagine a future, we would say you were depressed. But if you were a country, if we were a country that couldn't imagine a future, then what were we? And the one thing these recent demonstrations have done, and I'm sorry, once again, people had to be sacrificed in order for us to see it, is that we can imagine a future again as a nation.
That is, I'm debating whether to feel inspired or cynical on what you just said, but I'll opt for inspired.
If you have children,
yes,
you know, yeah. Take the first, it's your moral duty to, not your moral duty, but they're looking to you to believe. You think you're looking to them, but they're actually looking to you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably right. All right. Last question. I'll let you go. But if you were Biden, who would you pick as your VP and why?
Oh, wow. Well, I supported Pete Buttigieg because of the Douglas plan. Mm-hmm. And I think he will return to the national stage one day, as will the mayor of Minneapolis and mm-hmm. the mayor of Chicago, the mayor of Atlanta. We wish her well. Stacey Abrams is really brilliant. I have her new book. But I think I would pick Elizabeth Warren.
How come?
Because she does have, you know, this kind of policies in mind. And this is what we need. We need Angela Merkel. You know, we need to sort of get away from personality politics to policy. We need this kind of sober address to the nation as one composed of adults, the way Obama spoke to the nation. You know, he spoke to people who could reason, who could listen and reason. And we need sort of a return to that. The one thing about this latest twist in the rhetoric from the White House is that it's so throwback and the same old thing. And somehow we have to sort of step around all that and keep moving forward. I'm not so bothered by her manner because, you know, this is Harvard, this is Russell Street or Francis Avenue or whatever street they live on. But, you know, I'm not sort of bothered by that. She, you know, there's a lot to it. I don't think her being a woman will be a detriment or something, but, you know, when people said, I'm not against Hillary because she's a woman, I just don't like Hillary, but they forget why everyone disliked her in the first place, you know, as a right. woman interested in power openly.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's in the way, maybe in some way past. And I think that the young whose candidates didn't go all the way would find her someone they could relate to.
Yeah. We'll see in a few weeks. Yeah,
we'll
absolutely.
And I think also, you know, this time the vice presidential pick is very important for lots of reasons.
Right. So substantively, right, even more so. Right. You know, there's no clear evidence politically that the vice president ever makes a difference in the outcome of the election. I think the only one that you can point to in even recent history is LBJ and Kennedy.
Yeah.
And that's because Johnson literally just stole Texas, right? It wasn't even because he won the vote. They just stole it. And that's how they won the election, and Chicago maybe also.
I'm such a Kennedy person. I don't like to hear that.
You don't hear that, right?
No, it meant too much to us when I was little.
Yeah.
I could never get over it. So
understood. Understood.
No. Yeah. If I'm an Uncle Tom about anyone, it's President Kennedy. I know blah, 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 but I can't help it.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, last
thing.
It's
a bad thing to say because, you know, someone will say the same about Nixon. Well, you know, I love Nixon the same way.
I was reading Busted in New York, and I was reading the actual essay, Busted in New York. And what was funny is just you were talking about being on Second Avenue and Sixth Street and smoking a joint. And you know, just the period of time you were talking about, and I remember saying to myself, "Doesn't he know there's a precinct on that block?" And then you get arrested, and of course realize then that there was a precinct on that block. But it was
I know. And these are people who lived on the Lower East Side,
right?
You know, right. They knew. It just was, you know, no one thought anything about it. I mean, when we first were coming to the Lower East Side, it was the question of real estate. Nobody wanted it, which is why all those galleries and clubs and people moved there, because nobody else wanted it. And so people were very used to it being a very free zone. So the idea that realtors and other sort of authorities were taming the place still didn't catch on. Even, and this is 10 years after the Tompkins Square riot, so.
Yeah.
I'm writing a memoir about being Elizabeth Hardwick's student and discovering the New York Review of Books. And at the same time, it's about friends like Luc Sant, who have always managed me, who lived on the Lower East Side. So
yeah,
this period in the 70s is in the,
right.
This is what the memoir is about.
Of you know, Alphabet City, I think, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, this is amazing. Well, look, Darryl, thank you so much. It was really just
I'm sorry I rambled, but again, thank you very much for giving the chance to speak, and all the best to all of your listeners.
Likewise.
Stay safe, and let's all be brave.
Yep.
Somehow.
Yeah, somehow. We'll get there.
Thank you again. Right. Okay. Goodbye.